For example, if you, let's say that you go to, you know, a meeting, and instead of, you know, asking you to sit at the head of the meeting, you know, which you feel you deserve to sit at, you know, they say there's no chairs available, and they ask you to sit, you know, at the back of the room. But you don't feel bad about it, you know. You say, oh, it's okay. Right, this is a sign that you have, you know, arrived at the virtue of humbleness. Another thing, another criteria that the Imam mentions is that you greet whoever you meet. If you meet a person, you greet him, you say salam to him, you ask about him, you know, you meet him in a friendly way. Even, you know, if you don't like the person, or, you know, you feel that, you know, you're more qualified than the person, or, you know, more educated than the person, or more learned than him. In any case, you greet whoever you meet. This is another sign of humbleness. Finally, the Imam mentioned a very interesting criteria. He said, and give up dispute, even if you are right. Let's say that you're quarreling about something or arguing about something, a certain subject, or, you know, a certain matter with your friend or your colleague at work, or, you know, one of your classmates. And you know that you're right, or you feel that you're right, and you know that this person is wrong, right? If you can give up the dispute and stop arguing, and say, hey, let's forget about it, you know, maybe you're right, then this is another sign that you have arrived at humility and humbleness. These are three criteria, good criteria, that the Imam mentions, by means of which we can ascertain whether we have arrived at humility and humbleness or not. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the criteria of humbleness. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
What you heard was an IRIB English Radio program.
Methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today we listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
When we come to these gatherings, it's important that we're here not just with our bodies, not just with our minds, but also with our hearts. The stories that I like to begin the lecture with, or the ahadith I quote, are for the purposes of reviving the heart. When we come to these gatherings, it's an honor. It's tawfiq from Allah. It's an opportunity that He created for us. And it's important that we acknowledge this and feel the gratitude in our hearts. And by doing so, Allah says, La in shakartum la azidannakum. If you thank me, I will give you more. We're told that one time, two of the companions of Imam Ridha alayhi salam came to him. One of them, his name was Ahmad, the other was named Al-Husayn. They come to the Imam alayhi salam, they're devout followers, they love him, he's their leader, but they have a complaint. So when they go to him, they say to him that, oh, our Imam, life used to be good for us. But things have changed recently. We're going through some tough times right now. So could you make a dua so that things go back to the way they were before? And one of the things we're told in numerous traditions from the Ahlul Bayt is that the imams are always praying for their followers. We're also told that they're aware of what they're going through. And we're told that when we go through struggles, there's particular attention that our imams, as their job as being our leaders, that they are aware of those particular struggles that we're going through. In this case, Imam Ridha alayhi salam wants to test them. And I know that many of us, when we're coming to these gatherings, for a period of time, we're here and we're transported to a different world where we hear about these great ones, our heroes, our loved ones. But what we're putting aside are sometimes some deep problems and challenges that we're going through. And we're wondering that, can we find a relief from these problems? So these two men asked the Imam, is there some way that we can go back to the way we were before? The Imam asked them a question. He says that, do you wish to be kings on this earth, but that you should lose ma antum alay? Ma antum alay is an expression in hadith which means that you should lose your wilaya of the Ahlul Bayt, meaning that you lose your faith and your adherence to the guardianship of the Ahlul Bayt. Are you willing to give up your being a Shia and to become a king on the earth? They told him emphatically that, O Imam, even if we were to be given the entire earth filled with gold and silver, we would never, ever want to give up our faith and our being adherence to you. The value of knowing the Ahlul Bayt, the value of having them be our role models, our leaders, of having them be our heroes, is something which is very precious. And these two men knew it. So the Imam alayhi salam was happy with their answer, and now he wanted to advise them. He says to them that, he quotes to them the verse from the Quran in Surah Saba 34:13, where Allah Ta'ala says, اعملوا آل داود شكرا وقليل من عبادي الشكور. O family of Dawood, act in a way that you are grateful. And how little of my servants are grateful. How few of them are grateful. So first of all, he advises them, you should have an attitude of gratitude. And then he goes on to say that, have a good opinion of God. Because somebody who has a good opinion of God, God is with them where they put him. Meaning that, let's say that we say that, okay, we're trying our best. We've identified our faith. We're working towards it. Sometimes we make mistakes. We get back up. We seek forgiveness from God. We're trying to do our best. If things are a little bit tough for us, we shouldn't think that God has abandoned us. Allah Ta'ala tests us because He wants us to rise to higher stations. We should be reflecting on what we could do to improve, make amends, but we have to have hope. And when we have hope in Allah, then Allah is there for us. Point being that, brothers and sisters, when we come to these gatherings, this is an opportunity for us to not just be here, but to be here with our hearts and to be filled with gratitude that we have been chosen to be, inshallah, counted among those who mourned and grieved and participated in these gatherings to, inshallah, make our lives become more Husseini, more like Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Our topic over the last few nights has been the enlightened journey of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. The reason why we went back in history and looked at certain people like Ahnaf ibn Qais, like Usama bin Zayd, the reason why we looked at the historical treatment of religion was to understand how Jahiliyyah had crept back into the Muslim society at the time of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. How an era of ignorance and a lifestyle of ignorance had set back into the Muslim community. And the reason why we want to understand that is because there's this burning question, which is, how could this ummah allow the grandson of their very prophet to be killed and martyred while so few were supporting him? But the question we're having is not just historical. We want to connect it to our present times. That's why We've been making these connections with attitudes and ideologies and actions that people do in the modern era. Tonight, inshallah, my topic has to do with the jahiliyyah custom of barbarism, meaning being somebody who just kills and oppresses other people. And I'm going to, inshallah, make a connection between how that was revived at the time of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and how we're facing the revival of barbarism in the modern era as well, and what we can do about that. You all know that the Jahiliyyah period was, meaning the Jahiliyyah period before Islam, was one which was filled with like the worst type of behaviors. People eating the worst type of foods, having the worst type of relationships. But maybe the most outstanding characteristic of the ignorance of the period of ignorance is the amount of killing that took place and the complete lack of respect for lives. People who study that period, they say that generally speaking, people's religion was very, you know, not organized. There wasn't any like set of like aqaid, like usul ad-din, like principles of religion when it came to the people of Jahiliyyah. But if you wanted to say they had a religion, and if you wanted to say what was the one rule in that religion, it was the rule that if somebody attacks you, you must take revenge on them. So we're told that, for example, one of the wars that dragged on for decades was caused by the camel of one tribe going to the pasture of another tribe and grazing on their fields. And when the other tribe saw that the camel had come, they fired an arrow and the arrow hit the hump of the camel, and this began an entire war. And the war continued to the point where the people who were originally involved, they had left this world. And now their generations after them were fighting, and some of them had even forgotten what the reason for their fighting was. It was filled with complete lack of respect for life. And then we have the revelation of Islam. Allah chooses those people and He sends to them our Prophet. And our Prophet brings them life, real life, by telling them who is a human being and how should human beings be treated.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Hali Hakimun Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
Aperture.
Welcome back, everyone. In the first part, we saw how in 1951, inhabitants of a French village were suddenly tormented by terrifying hallucinations. At least seven people died, dozens were taken to a local asylum, and hundreds were affected. Immediately, wild theories started emerging to explain this mysterious case of mass insanity. There were claims of poisoned flour, contaminated water, and even witchcraft. The truth was stranger than any of these theories. The Central Intelligence Agency had spiked the local food with LSD as part of a mind control experiment at the height of the Cold War. And with time, U.S. government's interest in LSD shifted from a defensive to an offensive orientation. While the initial experiments with LSD were fairly simple, if shockingly unethical, over time these LSD experiments grew increasingly elaborate. Stay with us as victims reveal the naked truth in the next part of this program.
Entire populations bore the consequence of large-scale tests. Here are some examples. Again, uncontested cases that are recognized by the American government. In 1953, radioactive iodine was injected into newborns and pregnant women at Iowa University and also in Nebraska. In 1955, the CIA sprayed whooping cough bacteria off the coast of Tampa. Two died and dozens fell ill. Also in 1955, the CIA enlisted prostitutes in San Francisco, opened two brothels and tested drugs on the clients, then filmed through a one-way mirror. In 1956, the Army released millions of mosquitoes carrying yellow fever and dengue on the towns of Savannah and Avon. There were several deaths and hundreds of people infected. In 1960, in Cincinnati, the Army financed a radiation program on 90 destitute or ill inhabitants of the city's university hospital. Some died after several weeks. In 1966, the Army tested a virus in the New York Metro, then in Chicago. The bacteria was concealed in electric bulbs. The aim was to study the spread of chemical agents on a large scale. For these experiments, the Army or the CIA funded laboratories in the most prestigious universities: Yale, Stanford, Harvard, or Columbia. They all took part. Glorified by the idea of working for the nation's defense, the researchers went crazy.
Dr. Kligman in Philadelphia increases a dosage 468 times, which actually frightened Dow Chemical. They couldn't believe that a respected doctor would do that. In Washington, D.C., you had Walter Freeman, who was a very, very well-known lobotomist who traveled around the country doing lobotomies in his car. And he would use an ice pick. He could do 15 to 20 in a day. It was just incredible what some doctors did, and very few, if any, people in the hospital or the medical community blew the whistle on it. It really was an egregious act, and it showed that the medical community was more interested in protecting its ass than in protecting the test subject and the patients, because a lot of doctors went off the deep end and started doing things that are just inconceivable now.
To express his indignation, Alan Hornblum wrote half a dozen books. A former prison guard at Holmesburg in Pennsylvania, from his first day at work over 40 years ago, he had a horrible shock.
I was stunned to see scores of inmates with their shirts off, strapped and wrapped in bandages and gauze tape. And I couldn't imagine that I was going into an atmosphere that was that violent, because all of the men looked like they had just walked a cell block knife fight.
They explain that it's not because of any violence, but experiments that are carried out there. Alan was the first to denounce this scandal and would lose his job as a result.
It was probably the largest human experimentation factory in America, possibly the world. From 51 until 1974, more people were probably incorporated in more experiments than any other place in the world.
Drugs, viruses, cancerous cells, plutonium, sarin gas, the most toxic products were tested in Holmesburg, but also in dozens of prisons throughout the country. To condemn these experiments, Alan Hornblum found former inmates like Youssef. In 1961, this man was imprisoned for selling marijuana. He was poor, with limited education. He was offered a chance to take part in tests for $1 a day. Since then, Youssef has had his digestive tract operated on. He has liver and skin problems and can no longer work. His first test was for a bath foam from the company Johnson & Johnson.
They took tape and they stuck it on your back and pulled it off, stuck it on and pulled it off until the first layer of skin came off your back. And they put six sections on my back like that. And then they took a bottle with the Johnson & Johnson bubble bath and put it on a patch and put the patch over the raw area. Then they took a can. I recognized that can as being from the Army. And I was like, what Johnson & Johnson got to do with this? So he took the can and he sprayed it on my back. And when it hit my back, it was cold. But it was so toxic and like fumes, I could taste it in my mouth. And as I'm walking down, I'm getting dizzier and dizzier, dizzier and dizzier. By the time I stepped into my cell, I passed out. Boom, and my back was inflamed. And by the time I woke up that morning, I had great big blisters on my back full of pus. This rash just gets worse and worse. And it looks like when the moon come out at night, it flames up. And I'd be moaning and crying. My cell partners couldn't sleep. We goes over there, a little shot cup, and it looked like water. We drinks it. Everything became magnified. The sound, like the loudspeaker on the system. Ooh, ooh, ooh. The walls look like they turned into water. You know what I mean? And like I spent the whole time like looking around like this here instead of doing the test. So I goes back to the block in that condition. And man, I mean, I was tripping. And it was like a slow-acting drug that was in that cup. It lasts for weeks. The inmates start naming me Outer Limits. I had no conversation for nobody. I was scared of the inmates, and the inmates act like they was afraid of me.
What you had were hundreds and hundreds of uneducated minorities, overwhelmingly black and Puerto Rican, and then you had white doctors with white lab coats with PhD or MD after their name, and it was a recipe for abuse, if not disaster. And those prison walls are an ideal spot to do controversial experiments, because just as those walls keep the inmates in, they also keep the public out, so no one finds out about it.
Prisoners were used, but also patients. In certain hospitals, patients were steered towards the services financed by the CIA. These services carried out limitless experiments on psychological manipulation. In 1965, Karen Wetmore was only 13 when she was admitted to a hospital in Vermont. She stayed there several times in her childhood. She suffered from severe depression after falling victim to a pedophile neighbor. Admitted against her will, she was not allowed any contact with her family, being told that it was for her own good.
The CIA was specifically looking for children between the ages of 13 and 18 to further dissociate. They wanted dissociative children. Here's a sense of absolute and total helplessness. You're there, you're bound up, you're locked in this room. No matter how you scream, no matter what you say, no one is going to come. It does something to you, something you don't get over.
The doctors went to work on Karen. They wanted to erase her memory and create a robot at their command. It took 30 years of legal battles for Karen to obtain her medical records and discover the violence of the treatments she was subjected to.
It says seclusion, full cam. A cam is a straitjacket. And ties, which means they tied my arms and they tied my feet. This goes on uninterrupted, day after day, week after week, February, March, April, right up until June 21st, 1971. You sleep on the floor. On the floor. No blanket, no nothing. And my arms were secured like this, behind my back. I do remember that. It's extremely painful because it pulls on your neck, pulls on your shoulder. You can't get away from it. It's maddening is what it is. Maddening. And I was naked. And I think that was part of the effort of that experiment to break me down. Everything they did was to break me down.
Months in a confined room with no bearings, while her captors administered all kinds of drugs and sometimes electric shocks at inhuman levels.
Number of shocks and the seconds that they held the shocks. They 30, 30, 35, 35, 35, and they held it for sustained for 40 seconds. A normal shock would be a second. Certainly not 30 and 35 of them. One, not that many, which probably is what obliterated my memory right there. And I think that's why they did it. They also said, in this treatment right here, no seizure, shock restarted. So they gave me a second one because they couldn't produce a seizure. So they must have done it over again, must have repeated it. It's unforgivable. And I'm sure I wasn't the only one they did this to. I'm sure. I survived to be able to talk about it.
How many suffered similar experiments? In Montreal, Canada, the CIA used a world-renowned psychiatrist to set up a factory of guinea pigs in the Allen Memorial Psychiatric Department in McGill University. This psychiatrist was Ewan Cameron, one of the all-powerful presidents of the World Psychiatric Association. In 1945, Ewan Cameron made the acquaintance of Rudolf Hess, one of the Nazis accused in the Nuremberg trial. In 1957, the CIA recruited him for their MK-Ultra program. The Americans wanted to perfect their interrogation techniques and program a human to kill. Ewan Cameron became the mad dog of psychiatry. He put his patients in vegetative states for several weeks while bombarding them with pre-recorded orders. Some would become incontinent, amnesiac, forgetting even who their parents were and how to speak. The Vermont hospital where Karen Wetmore was confined was working on the same program in the hands of the CIA doctors. She was like a rag doll.
They used drugs like LSD. They used electric shock. They used chemical shock agent metrazole, which I was given in 1971. And I found that out in my medical records, which is a very brutal drug, very brutal drug. CIA said it was excruciating. Physically and emotionally, excruciating drug. I have a quote from the CIA that said that the Soviets used it in the gulags, and that a POW would say or do anything to avoid a second dose. Nice drug.
There's all kinds of people who believe and people who don't believe, and that's a debate about do you believe or don't believe. I'm always interested in what are in the documents saying. So the documents clearly describe implanting electrodes in people's brains, activating the electrode from a remote transmitter, and changing the person's behavior from angry, pounding the wall, sitting there just staring.
Behind Karen's ear is a scar, and she doesn't know what it's from.
Once my therapist really understood that I had really been experimented on by the CIA, she said to me, you know, just for the heck of it, let me look. Because we'd read about, there's been information about these implants.
And I'm like, okay. And it was there, actually there. This is, I showed you. I went to a plastic surgeon who told me it was a surgical scar. But there's nothing in my medical history, nothing in a medical record that shows any kind of problem ever behind my right ear, or any incision or any surgery or anything else. But there it is.
What stopped the journey down this destructive path? In 1973, while Watergate is rattling all the institutions, Richard Helms, director of the CIA, feels the winds of change. He works as a lone wolf and hasn't informed the president of these experiments. He knows he's crossed the line. To protect himself, he orders the destruction of all documents relating to the MKUltra program and its abandonment. 2 years later, in 1975, the President Gerald Ford orders an inquiry into the CIA. The Rockefeller Commission is sworn in. The task isn't simple, because at the heart of the CIA, even Richard Helms' close lieutenants know nothing about the brainwashing programs.
There's a lot of goofy things go on in a big agency like that with all that secrecy. Things can go on that you don't know about, that the people who are working for the director don't know about, or that the director doesn't know about. I mean, they're keeping it quiet down there. Don't tell anybody. If it works, then we'll tell them. But, you know, in the meantime, don't get into any difficulties. I remember when they wanted to take a kitty cat and stick a microphone up its rear end and put an antenna on its ear and have him walk in where we, if there's a spy in the park with another one, walk over and walk around and listen in on it. You know, they tried it one time in an experiment, and a taxi came by and ran over the cat, you know. So.
In reality, nothing is funny. In its haste to get rid of evidence, the CIA forgets 20,000 documents. A drop of water compared to the amount that was destroyed, but they reveal that it financed 149 programs, implicating 80 institutions, including the most respected. Called on to justify themselves, the heads of the CIA, like Dr. Lashbrook, lie and downplay the facts.
There was, of course, claims or thoughts that maybe great things could be done with hypnosis. One small project in which we had a hypnotist do some experiments, primarily to see what the limitations of hypnosis might be. Can you make a person do something under hypnosis that he would not ordinarily do?
Even if the head of the CIA, Richard Helms, tried to minimize the scale of the experiments, the victims' testimonies contradict him.
The next thing I remember,
the inquiry commissions follow, each reaching more and more witnesses, like this woman, Chris DeNicola. Her father put her in the hands of a reputed CIA doctor, Dr. Green, when she was 12 years old.
His objective was to gain control of my mind and train me to be a spy assassin. Dr. Green had electrodes on my body, including my head. He used what looked like an overhead projector and repeatedly said he was burning different images into my brain while a red light flashed aimed at my forehead. In between each sequence, he used electric shock on my body and told me to go deeper and deeper, while repeating each image would go deeper into my brain and I would do whatever he told me to do. Dr. Green moved on to wanting me to kill dolls that look like real children.
Inquiry reports that resulted from these terrifying testimonies revealed one thing for certain. The experiments ended in disaster. In its insane quest for a robot human or a truth serum, the CIA failed. On August 3, 1995, with the revelations mounting up, then-President Bill Clinton makes a public apology. Since then, a great number of secret archives have been released to the public domain. Researchers would take an interest in this troubled period, notably Hank Alberelli, who worked on the suspicious death of Frank Olson, the biochemist who worked at the heart of the CIA. Since 1951, the year of the Pont-Saint-Esprit incident, Frank Olson called into question the ethics of the experiments being carried out and became depressed as a result. In November 1953, the CIA put LSD into his glass without him knowing. 9 days later, he threw himself off the 13th floor of a New York hotel. Murder or suicide, we'll never know. At the time of the investigation, Hank Alberelli found a surprising document coming from the White House. It surprisingly linked the name of Frank Olson to Pont Saint-Esprit. Why, in the middle of the Korean War, would the White House be interested in this small French village? Even better, Hank also came across a study carried out by the CIA on LSD.
The document itself was a comprehensive overview or history, if you will, of LSD specifically, yes. Not on ergot. It had nothing to do with ergot. There was a section or a chapter, if you will, headed incident at Pont Saint-Esprit. And the first two paragraphs of that describe essentially what we've all read, you know, many times over in terms of what happened at Pont Saint-Esprit. But the remainder of that section, the rest of that page, which was about half the page, and the two pages that followed, were completely blacked out.
Above all was this damning document from the CIA. It dates from 1953 and has no doubt been declassified by mistake. A director at Sandoz Laboratories confirmed to a secret agent that the Pont Saint-Esprit incident was caused by LSD. Sandoz Laboratories was where Albert Hoffman worked, the man who discovered LSD. It even claimed the drug was responsible for the Pont Saint-Esprit tragedy, before recanting. This same document states that in 1952, the source at the CIA had already explained that the cursed bread was caused by LSD. Did French authorities try to silence the affair? Several years after the drama, a head of the Victims Association was shocked at how disinterested the investigators were. Do the French have something to hide? We've interrogated former members of the Secret Services, investigated national and regional archives, as well as those from the police and the Justice Department. The files are hard to find, and many important pieces, such as reports from main hearings, have disappeared. If America revealed unwillingly some of its secrets about its participation in the poisoning, the uncertainties over the involvement of the French authorities may yet go on for some years longer. It takes 75 years for some sensitive documents to be made public. Hidden in its small streets and stone buildings, Le Pont Saint-Esprit drama has yet to reveal all its secrets.
Judging from the CIA's dark and notorious past of misconduct, perhaps it'll be no surprise if horrific clandestine high-tech experiments are being carried out somewhere in the world by the CIA at this very moment. Secrets that we must wait 75 years to be declassified, if ever disclosed to the public at all. And that's everyone for this week on Aperture. It's goodbye.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Mr.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners from all around the world. This is IRIB English Radio, the program of Viewpoint. I am Beta, and here again, I'm honored to be the host of today's episode. And here with me, there are two dear guest speakers, Sheikh Rouhani and Brother Ali, here with me. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa
rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you for being here with me. And as you know, again, this episode, we're going to talk about something really common among our youth generation, a problem, maybe we can call it, because, as you know, in this modern world, we are facing depression more than any time in the human history. Depression, you know, wasn't that much accepted as a disease, but nowadays, as it is so spread around among people around the world, actually in psychological aspects and even biological aspects, we assume it and we actually name it as some spiritual and a psychological disease that I think all of the people around the world have actually gone through this in every period of their life. I don't want to go through the reasons of this depression that we feel, especially in this generation nowadays, but actually I want to go through the ways that we can prevent this disease from going and spreading around. And one of these things that I think is confronted and facing this depression is social happiness, the thing which actually is a bit ignored, I think, in our society and in the world. So let's have an explanation first about this social happiness and then go through other parts of it. Sheikh Rouhani, I'm all ear.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Of course, this social happiness or exhilaration is, of course, significant and important, that should be discussed and should be dealt with by the scholars, of course. And if we look at this question from this perspective, that how can we achieve this happiness in our life, it seems that happiness or feeling of satisfaction is a kind of feeling. When something is a kind of feeling, it is mostly something internal, it's not something external. I mean, by the outside of your feeling, I mean outside of your mind, if there are some facilities, some, let's say, opportunities for you, of course, it sometimes might make you happy. But what matters most is this, that this specific kind of feeling that you have is important. This feeling of satisfaction, where does it come from? Since sometimes we have the richest people in the world, the most popular people, the most rich people, the most, let's say, wealthy people, but they are not satisfied, you know, they are not happy. They are always full of depression. They are always using different kinds of tablets and, let's say, different kinds of medicines to cure themselves because of this kind of disease. Finally, sometimes even they kill themselves or they die out of this usage of different medicines. So now this question is that how can we bring happiness in our life? Can it come to us with the facilities, with material facilities? It's really difficult to say yes. Rather, it seems that feeling of satisfaction or feeling of happiness or exhilaration is something that comes from within our heart, from within our mind. We have sometimes some people who are very much happy in their lives, but they are not fully, let's say, their life is not fully facilitated. You know, I mean,
yeah.
They do not enjoy a very luxury life. But still they are happy. And those people who have the most luxurious life, they regret and they wish the life of this simple life of these people. So that's why it seems that feeling of satisfaction or feeling of happiness is something that might come from our worldviews, our, let's say, perspective, our, let's say, perception of our life, our world, our position, our duties, responsibilities in the world, let's say, the meaning of life that we define for ourselves, that we try to achieve, the efforts that we make to achieve those meaning for our life, to have a meaningful life. So, of course, if you have true beliefs, true ideas, then you can have true kind of life. Whenever you live truly in this world, you enjoy your life. You will be happy. You will have a kind of feeling of happiness. If you live wrongly in this world and you know that this system or this way that you live is something wrong, and of course you're always worried about it, you're always with lots of depression, with lots of hopelessness, and because you feel that you're living like a criminal in this world, and that's why
it's a bit too harsh, isn't it?
Yeah, and then you cannot feel happy. You know, this is the problem. But if you live truly in this world, based on true kind of beliefs, true worldview, true kind of teachings and doctrines and principles and values, of course, then you enjoy your life. That's why in our Shi'i school of thought, Ahlul Bayt school of thought, we believe that if you follow truly the Ahlul Bayt, of course, you will find
true happiness.
The pleasure, you will enjoy the life with lots of pleasures
happiness. Thank you, Sheikh Rouhani, for your elaboration on the content of happiness. Actually, happiness is really complicated nowadays because we can see many people with high level of facilities, money, and even some celebrities that they are not happy. Just, you know, they commit suicide and so on. And all of these things are the proof to whatever you told up to here. And so there should be some true meaning of happiness, which is divided and separated from all the outer standards that we set up to here, like money, like facility or anything. And as you told, there is this Islamic point of view on happiness that we have to go through the true path that actually is matched with our personality and humanity. And what do you think, Brother Ali, about the Islamic point of view in this regard of this social vitality and happiness that we lack in this modern world?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Happiness is one of the basic human emotions that plays a decisive role in ensuring the health of the human body, the human being, and also the society. Happiness, regardless of how it is being acquired, it can improve physical health of the person. So we see that happy people usually make better decisions, feel more secure, and actually more vital and have a cooperative spirit in the society. So this is quite tangible for us to see. So happiness, there is no doubt that it has a very important role in one's life. But the basis of the creation of the whole universe and the existence is in such a way that actually it automatically provides a sense of happiness for the people. The sunrise, or the gentle morning, or pleasant spring, or a beautiful waterfalls, or the nature, looking at the nature, or the sea, the kind of peace and tranquility that looking at the sea gives to a human being. Or colorful flowers and the connection of the two people when they come together, whether they are, for example, a couple or two old friends that when they meet each other. So these bring happiness to a person. So suppose a person is lacking all of these elements and at least is indifferent towards all of these things. So what would be the outcome? I mean, the person would not feel this sort of happiness inside himself or herself. And one more element of happiness that we have been ordered in our Islamic teachings is that we, the followers of the school of Ahlul Bayt, are happy with whatever actually makes the Ahlul Bayt happy. In the times of, for example, giving birth to one of the noble imams, or even when we have been, for example, we have been ordered to be happy in such occasions. And really it brings a sense of happiness for us. And we are all happy when we have some congregations and some assemblies, and we are happy on those ceremonies. Though some even better incidents also occur in opposite, but now since our discussion is about the happiness, so we are talking about this. But the limits that Islam defines for happiness is that we, a person, a Muslim, a duty-bound person, should not indulge in excess, that is, in extravagance, in happiness. So, for example, Islam suggests us to have such happiness, for example, in halal and, for example, halal relations or communications. So Islam disagrees with the kind of happiness that comes from the, for example, the other way, that is the haram ways. As, for example, talking and making, for example, jokes with the ones who are non-mahrams. So no, Islam is not with them. But the kind of, for example, morale that you have, or the way that, for example, you want to be happy with the people who belong to you, or your friends, or the ones who are mahram to you, at least. These are the ways that are suggested and actually are recommended to strengthen. So, but if we want to categorize different types of happiness, we can actually define them in three. We can actually categorize them in three ways. Passing happiness, the kind of happiness that actually usually passes very soon and ends very soon. Also, the emotional happiness, the happiness which actually are embedded with emotions. Again, they are a bit maybe longer than the passing ones. But the ones that are usually permanent kind of happiness. We have been ordered to focus on these deep and permanent forms of happiness. There are too many things that are permanent. I mean, they bring us permanent happiness, and we can focus on them. I mean, as Imam Ali alayhi salam in a narration said, that the happiness of a mu'min, the happiness of a person, is in gaining something that he will never lose it. So is there, I mean, in the universe and existence, that thing that gives us happiness and we cannot lose them? Yes, definitely. For example, the kind of relation that we can make due to deep prayer with the Creator. This kind of happiness, we might not be able even to describe it. I refer to a statement that has been said from the great and the late Ayatollah Bahjat, that he said, actually, what he said might have happened for himself. He said the things that some believers or some mystics gain in the status of prostration is something that they are not ready even to exchange it with the kingdom of the whole world.
Yeah.
So what kind of happiness that or joy and ecstasy is he talking about? That you are not ready to change it with something which has, I mean, the whole property of the world is under you. Right, so this happiness might be something else. Once, for example, one of the mystics was asked that, how can you describe us this happiness that you are talking about, this sense that you are too happy, that, for example, in the perfected way of it, for example, when a person meets Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he said, for example, suppose that you are going to eat a delicious food. The kind of happiness, or the kind of, let's say, joy that you gain from that food, how long does it take? For example, for 10 minutes or half an hour or 1 hour or 2 hours at most, right? You still have that beautiful taste that you have just eaten, right? He said that collect those hours and minutes of happiness that you had and experienced. Multiply them by 1,000, multiply them by 1,000, multiply them by 1,000. Yeah. Still, you will not find that beautiful happiness that those great scholars or mystics are talking about.
This is really beautiful.
Because al-majaz qantarat al-haqiqa, that is, what we see in the world in reality might have its root in the divine world, but there is much more stronger.
Yeah,
so what this happiness, that permanent happiness that we have been ordered and recommended to focus and to work for them, actually they even come from the real happinesses, that the real signs and occasions of happiness, for example, through the beauty of the sea that we look at. So it can give us a sense of calm, a sense of tranquility and calmness.
Peace.
And then it strengthens this happiness inside us towards inner peace.
Thank you, dear listeners, for listening to us. I actually wish it was useful for you. I bid you farewell. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Standing here alone on a land so far from home, a place where angels cry, while little children die. Hussein said goodbye, praying some of them survive the torture and the heat. They can't bear to watch him leave. They cry out, Hussein, ya Hussein, ya Hussein, this is Karbala. Zainab left her heart. She left her brothers in the dust. But there's much more pain to come. This is the road to Sham. Harqayu won't last long. Hussein, she won't make the journey home. She cries, ya Hussein, ya Hussein. You
have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
A
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Welcome back, my dear audience, to the series of programs by For Humanity. I am Hamza Azizi from IRIB English Radio, and we are